He turned and waved at his two fellows, showing them the money. Kungus almost smiled himself then. The other two woodcutters, still waiting 20 yards up the trail, had obviously been ready to bolt into the forest at the first sign of treachery. Now they trotted eagerly forward.
"And that's another thing," grumbled Cujulo. "I miss the trusting atmosphere of the Vile One's palace."
The Kushans, who were close enough to hear him, burst into laughter. Even Kungus grinned. The noise startled the woodcutters, but then, seeing that the jest wasn't aimed at them, they relaxed. Not much, of course. Within seconds, they were scampering down the trail toward their village 10 miles away, being very careful to skirt the 500 Kushan soldiers coming up that trail. Kungus strode forward.
"Let's take a look at this mighty fortress, shall we?"
20 minutes later, Cujulo was complaining again.
"I don't believe this shit. Those are guards? That's a fortress?"
Kungus and the 5 other Kushan troop leaders who were gathered alongside him, examining the fortress from a screen of trees, grunted their own contempt. They were situated southeast of the fortress. The structure was perched on top of a small hill just before them. 200 feet tall, that hill, no more. On the other side of the hill, still invisible to the Kushans concealed within the trees, stretched the huge reaches of the ocean. The forest, which blanketed the coast, was thinner on the hill, but not much. Some trees, mature, full-grown ones, were growing at the base of the fortress's walls. The branches of one particularly large tree even spread over part of the battlements.
"What kind of idiots don't clear the trees around a fortress?" demanded Cujulo.
"My favorite kind of idiots," replied Kungus softly. "Really, really, really idiotic idiots."
Kungus turned to face his subordinates. For once, he was actually smiling. A real, genuine smile, too. Not the crack in his iron face that usually passed for such.
"What do you think? Can we do it?"
5 sarcastic grunts came in reply. Cujulo pointed a finger at the fortress's entrance. The heavy wooden gates on the fortress's south side were wide open. In front of them, in the shelter provided by a makeshift canopy, 8 Malwa soldiers lounged at their ease. Only one of them was even bothering to stand. The rest were sprawled on the ground. 2 were apparently sleeping. The other 5 seemed to be engaged in a game of chance.
"Fuck the scaling equipment," growled Cujulo. "No need it. I can get my men within 10 yards of those pigs without being seen. A quick rush and we've got the gate."
"How long could you hold it, do you think?" asked Kungus.
The Kushan commander studied the trees growing on the hill.
"You can get your men up there without being seen, but I don't think I can get more than 3 other squads close before they're spotted. The rest of us will have to wait here until you start the attack."
He glanced up, gauging the weather. The sky was overcast, but Kungus didn't think it would rain anytime soon. Not for several hours, at least. He lowered his gaze and examined the hill itself, estimating the distance and the condition of the terrain.
500 feet. Muddy, steep climb. It'll take us 2 minutes.
Cujulo sneered.
2 minutes? You think I can't hold a big gate like that against those sorry shits? With the help of 3 other squads for a lousy 2 minutes?
Kungus was amused. Cujulo's complaint this time was filled with genuine aggrievement.
"Do it, then. Pick whichever other squads you want for immediate support. While you're working your way up the hill, I'll get the rest of the men ready for the main charge."
Cujulo began to rise. Kungus stayed him with a hand on the shoulder.
"Remember, Cujulo, prisoners, as many as we can get, especially the ones who are manning the cannons. We'll need them later."
Cujulo nodded. An instant later, he was gone. The other troop leaders didn't wait for Kungus's orders to start organizing the small army for an assault. Kungus didn't bother to oversee their work. He had handpicked the officers for this expedition and had complete confidence in them. He simply spent the time studying the fortress, trying to determine, as best he could, the most likely internal layout of the structure. Despite the slackness of its guards, the fortress itself was impressive. A simple square in design, the walls were thick, well-cut stone rising 30 feet from the hilltop. The corners were protected by round towers rising another 10 feet above the battlements. 2 similar round towers anchored the gatehouse guarding the entrance. Along with the usual merlons and embrasures, the battlements also sported machicolations, enclosed stone shelves jutting a few feet out from the walls, with slots through which projectiles or boiling water could be dropped on besiegers below. The open embrasures were further strengthened by the addition of wooden shutters, which could be closed to shield against missiles. Those battlements would have posed a tremendous challenge if the walls had been manned by alert guards. As it was, during the minutes that he watched, Kungus saw only four soldiers appear atop the fortress. From their position, it was obvious that they were moving along an allure, or rampart walk, which served as the fighting platform for the battlements. But the Malwa were simply ambling along, preoccupied with their own business. Not one of those soldiers cast so much as a glance at the surrounding forest. He tried to spot the location of the three siege guns, but couldn't see them. He knew they were there. Days earlier, from fishermen brought aboard Shakuntala's flagship, Kunkus had heard good descriptions of the fortress's seaward appearance. There was some kind of heavy stone platform on the fortress's northwest corner. Atop that platform rested the siege guns. From that vantage point, the huge cannons could cover the harbor of Supara less than half a mile to the north. But they were on the opposite side of the fortress from where Kungus lay waiting in the trees. Inwardly, he shrugged. He wasn't concerned about the cannons for the moment. The Maratha fishermen had no idea how those cannons worked or were positioned. Kungus himself, for that matter, had only a vague notion. Despite the many years he had served the Mawa, he had never gotten a close look at their siege guns. The Mawa were always careful to keep the Kushan and Rajput vassals from knowing too much about the Veda weapons, but he knew enough, both from his own knowledge and the information imparted by the Ethiopians, to know that such enormous cannons could only be moved with great difficulty. There would be absolutely no way the Malwa in the fortress could reposition them in time to repel the coming assault. Speaking of which, he thought that Kujula was probably in position by now. No way to tell for sure, of course. Kungus had selected Kujula to lead the attack because of the man's uncanny stealth. Not even Kungus, knowing what to look for, had caught more than a glimpse or two of Kujulo's men as they worked their way carefully up the hill. He was quite sure the Malwa guards had seen nothing. He swiveled his head slowly, scanning right and left. He was pleased, though not surprised, to see that his entire army was in position, waiting for the signal. Satisfied, Kungus turned his eyes back to the fortress. As if that little head motion had been the signal, Kujulo launched his attack. Kungus couldn't see all the details of that sudden assault, partly because of the distance, mostly because of Kujulo. That was the other reason Kungus had picked the man. Quick, quick he was, he and the men whom he had trained. Quick, quick, merciless. He saw Kujulo's 10 men lunging out of the trees. They had gotten within 10 yards of the guard canopy without being spotted. 3 seconds later, the killing began. 8 seconds later, the killing ended. Most of that time had been spent spearing the 5 Malwa gamblers, whose squalling, writhing, squirming huddle had presented a peculiar obstacle to the Kushan soldiers, almost like spearing a school of fish. Kungus watched none of it, however. As soon as he saw Kujulo's men lunge out of the trees, he gave the order for the general assault. 500 Kushans, less the 40 already charging the gate, began storming up the hill. It was a veteran kind of storm. The Kushans paced themselves carefully. There was no point in arriving at the fortress too exhausted to fight. Kujulo and his men would just have to hold on as best they could. The task proved much less difficult than it should have been. Before the alarm was sounded within the fortress, Kujulo and his squad had not only killed the 8 guards outside the gates, but had managed to penetrate the gatehouse itself. The tunnel through the gatehouse was occupied by 2 other men, neither of whom was any more alert than the 8 soldiers lounging outside the gate. Kujulo himself killed the 2 Malwa soldiers in the gatehouse. That done, he immediately tried to find the murder holes, but searching the ceiling which arched over the entryway, he could see none. One of his soldiers trotted up to him. Like Kujulo, the man's eyes were examining the stonework above, looking for the holes through which enemies could thrust spears or drop stones and boiling water. "Don't see him," he muttered. Kujulo shook his head. "Aren't any." He spit on the stone floor, then made for the far entrance. His squad followed. 5 seconds later, soldiers from the 3 squads serving as their immediate backup began pouring into the entryway. The entryway, in effect a stone tunnel running straight through the gatehouse, was 30 feet long and about half as wide. The arched ceiling, at its summit, was not more than 12 feet high. The inner gate, opening into the fortress's main ground, was standing wide open. When Cujulo reached it, he saw that there were no Malwar troops standing guard. "Fucking idiots," he sneered. He could hear shouts coming from somewhere inside the fortress. The alarm had finally been given. Either someone had heard the sound of fighting, or a guard standing atop the battlements had seen the attack. After passing through the inner gate, Cujulo took 3 steps forward before stopping to study the situation. The inside of the fortress was designed like a hollow square. The walls on the north, east, and south of the structure were simply fortifications. Outside of the horse pens and corrals nestled up against the northeast corner, there were no rooms built into the walls themselves. The western end of the fortress was a different proposition altogether. There, massive brick buildings abutted directly against the outer wall. Above those buildings, resting on a stone platform reinforced with heavy timbers, Cujulo could see the fortress's 3 great cannons. Those buildings would be the quarters for the garrison. Already, Cujulo could see Malwa soldiers spilling out from the many doors set into the brickwork. The soldiers fumbled with spears and swords. Many of them were still putting on their armor. Flimsy leather armor. Cujulo almost laughed, seeing one of the Malwa stumble and flop on his belly. But Cujulo could see no grenades, and what was better...
"Look at that, will you?" exclaimed one of his men. "They can't have more than 200 men guarding this place."
Cujulo nodded. His squad member had immediately spotted the most important thing about the fortress. The first thing Cujulo himself had noticed. No tents. The flat, empty ground which formed most of the fortress's interior should have been covered with tents. There wasn't enough room in the brick buildings for more than a small garrison. Cujulo thought his squad member's estimate of 200 was overgenerous. The garrison's officers, for one thing, would have undoubtedly taken the largest rooms for themselves. For another, Cujulo could see no sign of any cook fires on the open ground. That meant a kitchen, taking up even more of the brick building's space.
150 tops, he pronounced.
He studied the Malwa soldiers advancing toward them from the west, if the term advancing can be used to describe a mode of progress that was as skittish as a kitten's. Study the soldiers, and more closely their leather armor.
Shit.
He spit on the ground. Those aren't soldiers. Not proper ones. Those are nothing but fucking gunners. Cannon handlers. His squad was now ranged on both sides of him. Behind, he could hear the 30 men from the next 3 squads moving up. One of his men grinned, like wolves eyeing a herd of caribou.
"I do believe you're right," said one.
Another laughed.
"Think we can hold this gate against them? For the minute it'll take Kungus to get here?"
Again, Cujulo spit on the ground.
"Fuck that," he snarled. "I intend to defeat those bastards. Follow me."
He stalked toward the Malwa gunners. By now, all 4 squads had taken position in a line stretching 1/3 of the way across the inner grounds. 40 Kushans, wearing good scale armor, hefting their swords and spears with practiced ease, began marching on the Malwa. The gunner stopped, stared. Cujulo broke into an easy trot. 40 Kushans matched his pace. The gunner stared, edged back. Cujulo raised his sword and bellowed the order to charge. Shrieking like madmen, 40 Kushans charged the 100 or so Malwa some 30 yards away. The gunners turned and raced for the brick buildings. Half of them dropped their weapons along the way. By the time Kungus arrived a minute or so later, Cujulo was already organizing a siege, and complaining bitterly that he would have to go into the fucking forest and cut down a fucking tree, since the fucking Malwa didn't have any fucking timber big enough to ram through the fucking doors. Cutting down a tree proved unnecessary. The siege was perhaps the shortest in history. As soon as the Malwa gunners forted up in the brick building saw Kungus's 500 men storming into the fortress, they immediately began negotiating a surrender. The biggest obstacle in those negotiations were the 5 Mahaveda priests holed up with the gunners. The priests, bound by holy oaths to safeguard the secret of the Veda weapons, demanded a fight to the death. They denounced all talk of surrender as impious treason. Kungus, hearing the priests' shouting voices, called out his own offer to the Malwa gunners.
Cut the priests' throats. Pitch their bodies out. You'll be given good treatment.
The first corpse sailed through one of the doors not 15 seconds later. Within a minute, the lifeless bodies of all five priests were sprawled in the dirt of the fortress grounds. Kungus cocked his head at Kujulo.
What's your opinion? Think those gunners will spill their secrets?
Kujulo spit on the ground.
Imagine so. Especially after I reason with them.
We're family men, complained the garrison commander. He was squatting in the middle of the fortress's gun platform where Kungus had chosen to interrogate him. Kungus himself was standing by one of the great siege guns 5 feet away. Near him, Kujulo sat on a pile of stone cannonballs.
They told us this was just garrison work, whined the captured officer. A formality, sort of.
Kungus studied the man quivering with fear in front of him. It was obvious that the garrison was not one of the Malwa's elite Kshatriya units. Technically, true, many of the gunners were Kshatriya, but just as there are dogs and dogs, poodles and pit bulls, so also are there Kshatriya and Kshatriya. Kungus realized that Rao's savage guerrilla war had stretched Venandakatra's resources badly. The Goptri of the Deccan didn't have enough frontline troops to detail for every task, so he'd assigned one of his sorriest units to garrison Supara's fortress. And why not, he mused. Supara's on the coast side of the Western Ghats. Too far away for Venandakatra to worry about. Too far away for Rao to strike at, even if he wanted to. But none of his good cheer showed on his face. Kungus eyed the captive stonily. The garrison commander flinched from that pitiless gaze.
We're fathers and husbands, he wailed. Way too old for this kind of thing. You won't hurt our families, will you? We brought them with us to Supara.
Kujulo sat erect, his eyes widening. With a little sideways lurch, he slid off the pile of cannonballs and strode over to the Malwa commander. Then, leaning over the frightened officer, he barked,
Brought your families, did you? Women, too? Wives and daughters?
The garrison commander stared up at Kujulo's leering countenance. The Kushan's expression was venery and lust personified. Gleaming eyes, loose lips, even a hint of slobber. Now completely terrified, the officer looked appealingly toward the Kushan commander.
Depends, growled Kungus, face like an iron mask.
On what?
Squeaked the officer. Kungus made a little gesture, ordering the man to rise. The Mawa sprang to his feet. Another gesture. Follow me. Kungus walked over to the edge of the gun platform. A low stone wall, 2 feet high, was all that stood between him and a vertical drop of about 100 feet. The western wall of the fortress, atop which the gun platform was situated, rose straight up from a stone escarpment. To the northwest, the town and harbor of Supara were completely within view. View and cannon range. Gingerly, the Malwa officer joined Kungus at the wall. Kungus pointed at the harbor below, to the 3 war galleys moored in that harbor more precisely.
It depends on whether...
He broke off, seeing that the Malwa officer wasn't listening to him. Instead, the garrison commander was staring to the southwest. Kungus followed his eyes. On the horizon, barely visible, were the sails of a fleet. A vast fleet, judging from their number.
Ah, he grunted. Just in time.
He bestowed his crack in the iron version of a smile on the Malwa officer.
Such a pleasure, you know, when things happen when they're supposed to, don't you think?
The garrison commander transferred his stare from the distant fleet to Kungus. Again, Kungus pointed to the 3 galleys in the harbor below.
Depends, he growled.
The Malwa's eyes bulged.
You can't be serious, he exclaimed.
Kungus flicked his eyes toward Kujulo. The Malwa's eyes followed. Kujulo, standing 15 feet away, grinned savagely and grabbed his crotch. The Malwa recoiled, pallid-faced.
Depends, growled Kungus. Depends on whether you and your men destroy those 3 ships for us. Depends also on whether you show us how to use the cannons.
Silence followed for a minute. The garrison commander stared at the galleys below. and Cujulo listened again to the growl.
Depends.
The first cannon fired when Shakuntala's flagship, in the van of the fleet, was not more than 3 miles from the entrance to the harbor. The Empress and her Peshwa, standing in the bow, saw the cloud of gun smoke. Moments later, heard the roar. Another cannon fired. Then a third.
Are they firing at us? Queried Holker.
Ruefully,
I'm afraid my eyes aren't as good as they used to be.
The Empress of Andhra had young eyes and good ones.
No, Dadaji. They are firing at something in the harbor. Malwa warships, I assume.
Holker sighed.
Kungus has done it, then. He has taken the fortress.
Young eyes, good eyes, suddenly filled with tears.
My Mahedandanayaka, she whispered. Bhattasvapati.
She clutched Holker's arm and pressed her face against his shoulder. For all the world, like a girl seeking shelter and security from her father.
And you, my Peshwa.
As the huge fleet sailed toward the harbor of Supara, Dadaji Holker held his small empress in his arms. Thin arms they were, attached to the slender shoulders of a middle-aged scholar. But in that moment, they held all the comfort which the girl needed. If an empress found shelter there, the man himself found a greater comfort in the sheltering. His own family was lost to him, perhaps forever. But he had found another to give him comfort in his search. A child here, a brother there on the fortress above. A bigger, tougher kind of brother. The kind every bookish man wishes he had.
Mine too, he murmured, staring at the clouds of gun smoke wafting over the distant harbor.
My Mahedandanayaka. My Bhattasvapati.
Chapter 30. The Euphrates. Autumn, 531 AD. Tell me again, said Belisarius. Standing next to the general on top of the giant pile of rocks which the Kushans had hauled out of the Nahar Malka, Morris decided to misunderstand the question.
15,000 cavalry they've got now, he gruffed.
He pointed a stubby, thick finger at the cloud of dust rising out of the desert some 10 miles to the southeast.
5,000 of them, by my estimate, are Lakhmid Arabs. They're riding camels, the most, and...
Belisarius smiled crookedly. Tell me again, Morris. The Kiliarch puffed out his cheeks, sighed.
This is not my province, General. I don't have any business mucking around in...
I'm not asking you to muck around, growled Belisarius. And spare me the protestations of humble modesty. Just tell me what you think. Again, Morris puffed out his cheeks, then exhaled noisily.
What I think, General, is that the Emperor of Persia is offering the Roman Empire a dynastic marriage between Phocius and the eldest daughter of his noblest Sardaran.
Morris glanced down at Barismenus. The father of the daughter in question was perched 60 feet away on a large boulder further down the man-made hill, out of hearing range. Morris continued.
He'd offer one of his own daughters in marriage. Khusro made that clear enough, but he doesn't have any. So Barismenus's daughter is the best alternative, other than choosing from one of his brothers or half-brothers' various girls.
Belisarius shook his head.
That's the last thing he'd do.
Khusro's trying to bridle that crowd of ambitious brothers, and if I'm reading him right, trying to cement the most trustworthy layers of the nobility to his rule. The general scratched his chin, idly staring at the cloud of dust in the desert. His eyes weren't really focused on the sight, however. From experience, he knew that the Malwa army advancing on him would not be in position to attack until the following day. In the meantime,
Khusro's canny, he said.
Part of our conversation in Babylon consisted of his questions regarding the Roman methods of organizing our empire. I think he's planning, groping, is maybe a better way to put it, to break Persia from its inveterate...
He paused.
The word feudalism would mean nothing to Morris. It had meant nothing to Belisarius either, until Aid explained it to him. Traditions, he concluded, waving his hand vaguely.
Think he can do it? Asked Morris. Persians are set in their ways.
Belisarius pondered the question. Aid had given him once a vision of the Persia which Khusrow Anushirvan had created, in the future which would have been if the new gods hadn't intervened in human history. The greatest emperor of the Sassanid dynasty had tried to impose centralized imperial authority over the unruly Aryan nobility, inspired by Rome's example to some degree, guided by his own keen intelligence for the rest. In many ways, Khusrow would succeed. He would break the military power of the great aristocracy. He would win the allegiance of the Dagans, transform them into the social base for a professional army paid and equipped by the emperor, and place them under the authority of his own generals. Spabads, he would call them. Never again would ambitious Sadarans or Wuzurgans pose a threat to the throne. Khusrow would succeed elsewhere, too. His greatest reform, the one for which history would call him Khusrow the Just, would be his drastic overhaul of taxation. Khusrow would institute a system of taxation which was not only far less burdensome to the common folk, but which also stabilized the imperial treasury. Yet, if there was one thing which Aid had shown Belisarius, it was that human history never moved in simple, clear channels. Khusrow's dynasty, the Sassanid dynasty, would vanish into history as all dynasties did. But his tax system would remain. The Arab conquerors of Persia would be so impressed by it that they would use it as the model for the tax system of the great Muslim caliphates. Belisarius's mind was now wandering very far from the moment. He knew of the Muslim caliphates of the future that would have been. Aid had shown him, just as Aid had shown him the fall of the Roman Empire, almost 1,000 years in the future, the sack of Constantinople at the hands of the so-called Fourth Crusade, the final conquest of Byzantium, a quarter of a millennium later, by a new people called the Turks. Belisarius wondered now, as he often had before, what he thought of all that Aid had shown him. He was a general in the service of the Roman Empire, indeed one of the greatest generals which Rome ever produced. He knew that for a simple fact, and knew also that he was the only general in the long history of that great empire who fought for it while understanding all along that the empire was doomed. He hoped to save Rome and the world from Malwite tyranny, but he wouldn't save Rome itself. Rome would fall, some day, somehow. If not by the hand of Sultan Mehmet and his Janissaries, by the hand of someone else. All human creations fell or collapsed or simply decayed. Some day, somehow, somewhere. Mentally, Belisarius shrugged. His was not the task of creating a perfect human future. His was the task of making sure that people had a future they could create. Create badly, perhaps, but create. Not be forced into a mold created for them. Morris was still waiting patiently for an answer. Belisarius smiled and gave him the simple one. Yes, he can do it. He will do it. Morris grunted. The grunt carried a great deal of satisfaction, which was odd, really, for a Roman soldier. But Morris had met Khusrow Anushirvan, and like many people, even that crusty veteran had come under the spell of the Persian emperor's powerful personality.
What do you think, he now asked, about the proposal for a dynastic marriage, I mean?
Belisarius smiled again.
I think it's a great idea.
Theodora will be twitchy about it, of course, but Justinian will seize on it with both hands. Morris frowned.
Why?
Because Justinian always has his mind's eye, let's call it, on the position of the dynasty. His dynasty, for all that Photius is in his own son. And he knows that there'd be nothing that would cement the army's allegiance more than a dynastic marriage with a Persian princess.
Morris tugged his beard thoughtfully. True enough, he agreed. Anything that would prevent another bloody brawl with those tough fucking Dagans. Bad for your retirement prospects, that is.
A thought came to him. His eyes widened slightly.
Now that I think about it, when was the last time a Roman emperor married a Persian noblewoman?
Belisarius chuckled.
It's never happened, Morris. The Persians consider us Roman mongrels unfit for their blood.
That's what I thought, mused Morris. God, the army will be tickled pink. They already think of Photius as one of their own, you know. If he marries a Persian Sateron's daughter...
The Kiliarch broke off, eyeing the figure of Beresmenus below.
Does he know about it, do you think? It's his daughter we're talking about, after all. Maybe he won't like the idea.
Belisarius laugh, clapping the Kiliarch on the shoulder.
Unless I'm badly mistaken, Morris, the whole thing was Barrasminas's idea in the first place.
As if he had been cued, Barrasminas chose that moment to turn his head and look up at the two Roman officers standing on the very top of the rock pile. For a moment, he and Belisarius stared at each other. Then Barrasminas hopped off the rock. His shoulder might be half crippled, but he was still quite spry for a middle-aged man, and began climbing toward them. As soon as he reached the hilltop, Barrasminas asked,
"So, what do you think?"
For a moment, the Roman general was startled. How could Barrasminas have overheard? Then, realizing that the Sardaran was talking about their military situation, Belisarius grimaced.
"We're not going to be able to surprise them with another flank attack, that's for sure."
Barrasminas nodded. Neither he nor Belisarius had really thought that option would be available. Having been shattered at Anatha, the Malwu wouldn't make the mistake of overconfidence again. The army approaching them from the southeast was much larger than the force they had faced at the hunting park. Still, the commander of those oncoming Malwa was keeping a massive guard on his flanks. Well out on his flanks, using his best troops for the job. On his left, in the desert, the Malwa commander was using Lachmids on camelback. On his right, in the fertile terrain on the other side of the almost dry Euphrates, he was using Kushan cavalry. 4,000 of them, according to Kurusha's scouts, maintaining an excellent marching order with a large contingent of skirmishers guarding their own flank. There would be no way to surprise the Malwa with any clever maneuver with concealed troops. Not this time.
"We will have to rely on your main plan, then," said Barrasminas.
The Sardaran heaved a sigh.
"Casualties will be high."
Belisarius tightened his lips.
"Yes, they will, but I don't see any other option."
Barrasminas turned his head, staring to the west. Across the river, he could see the huge camp where Ormazd's 20,000 lancers and archers had taken position after arriving the week before. Even at the distance, he could see Ormazd's own pavilion towering over the much less elaborate tents of his soldiers.
"If he does not..."
"He will," said Belisarius confidently. His crooked smile came in full force. "You will have noticed, I'm sure, that Ormazd pitched his camp there instead of further down the river." Barrasminas nodded, scowling.
"A swine," he growled.
"Upstream of the dam, where he pitched his camp, there's no way he can cross the Euphrates in time to give you help should you need it. He should have taken position several miles further down, where the riverbed is almost empty."
Belisarius shook his head.
"Not a chance, Barrasminas. His troops would take the brunt of the assault then, whereas now... they are obviously out of the action," concluded the Sardaran. "The Malwa will recognize that immediately and concentrate most of their forces here. They will only need to keep a screen against the chance of Ormazd attacking their left."
Belisarius chuckled, making clear his opinion on the likelihood of Ormazd ordering any massive sally. The Persian emperor's half-brother, it was clear, intended to sit on his hands while the Romans and the Malwa army slugged it out on the other side of the Euphrates.
"How did he explain it?" demanded Barrasminas angrily.
Belisarius shrugged. "In all truth, he didn't have much explaining to do. I didn't press him on the matter, Barrasminas. I want him where he is." Barrasminas's scowl deepened. Intellectually, the Sardaran understood Belisarius's stratagem. Emotionally, however, the Aryan nobleman still choked at the idea of actually using another Aryan's expected treachery. A Sassanid, no less. Barrasminas eyed the Roman general.
"I forget sometimes just how incredibly cold-blooded you can be," he muttered. "I cannot think of another man who would develop a battle plan based on his expectation that an ally would betray him. Take such a possibility into account, certainly. Any sane commander does that when fighting with foreign allies. But to plan on it, no, more, to actually engineer it, to maneuver for it."
Barrasminas fell silent, shaking his head. Belisarius, for his part, said nothing. There was nothing to say, really. Despite the many ways in which he and Barrasminas were much alike, there were other ways in which they were as different as two men could be. For all his sophistication and scholarship, Barrasminas was still at bottom the same man who had spent his boyhood admiring Persian lancers and archers. spent hours of that boyhood watching de guns on the training fields of his father's vast estate, demonstrating their superb skill as mounted archers. Whereas Belisarius, for all his own sophistication and subtleties, was still, at bottom, the same man who had spent his boyhood admiring Thracian blacksmiths. Spent hours of that boyhood watching the blacksmiths on his father's modest estate, demonstrating their own more humble, but when all is said and done, much more powerful craft. Men die by the Dagon steel. People live by the blacksmith's iron. Even as a boy, however, Belisarius had had a subtle mind. So where other boys admired the strength of the blacksmith and gasped with awe at the mighty strokes of hammer on anvil, Belisarius had seen the truth. The blacksmith was a strong man of necessity, but a good blacksmith did everything he could to husband that strength. Time after time, watching, the boy Belisarius had seen how cunningly the blacksmith positioned the glowing metal, and with what a precise angle he wielded the hammer. So he said nothing to Barrasminus. There was nothing to say. A few minutes later, called down by one of his tribunes with a problem, Morris left the artificial hilltop. Belisarius and Barrasminus remained there alone, studying the huge Malwa force advancing toward them. They didn't speak, other than to exchange an occasional professional assessment of the enemy's disposition of its forces. On that subject, not surprisingly, they were always in agreement. If Barrasminus didn't have his Roman allies' sheer military genius, he was still an experienced and competent general in his own right. Underlying that agreement, however, and for all their genuine friendship, two very different souls readied for the coming battle. The one, an Arian Sardaran, noblest man of the noblest line of the world's noblest race, sought strength and courage from that very nobility. Sought for it, found it, and awaited the battle with a calm certitude in his own valor and honor. The other, a Thracian born into the lower ranks of Rome's parvenu aristocracy, never even thought of nobility. Thought not once of honor or of valor. He simply waited for the oncoming enemy, patiently, like a blacksmith waits for iron to heat in the furnace. A craftsman at his trade. Nothing more and nothing less. Chapter 31 Alexandria, autumn, 531 A.D.
Mrs. Madness! Shouted one of the gymnasiarchs.
The portly notable was standing in the forefront of a small crowd packed into the audience chamber. All of them were men, all of them were finely dressed, and most were as fat as he was. Alexandria's city council.
Madness!
Echoed another member of the council.
Lunacy!
Cried a third. Antonina wasn't certain which particular titles those men enjoyed. Gymnasiarchs also, perhaps, or possibly exegetae. She didn't care. The specific titles were meaningless. Hoary traditions from the early centuries of the empire, when the city council actually exercised power. In modern Alexandria, membership in the council was purely a matter of social prestige. The real authority was in the hands of the Praetorian prefect, the commander of the army of Egypt, and, above all, the patriarch. After disembarking her troops, Antonina had immediately seized a palace in the vicinity of the great harbor. She wasn't even sure whose palace it was. The owner had fled before she and her soldiers occupied the building, along with most of his servants. Each of the many monarchs who had ruled Egypt in the 862 years since the founding of Alexandria had built their own palaces. The city was dotted with the splendiferous things. Over the centuries, most of those royal palaces had become the private residences of the city's high Greek nobility. No sooner had she established her temporary headquarters than the entire city council appeared outside the palace, demanding the right to present their petitions and their grievances. She had invited them in, well over 100 of the self-important folk, simply in order to gauge the attitude of Alexandria's upper crust. Within 10 minutes after they surged into the audience chamber, they had made their sentiments clear. As follows. 1. The empire was ruled by a madwoman. 2. The mad empress had sent another madwoman to spread the madness to Alexandria. 3. They, on the other hand, were not mad. 4. Nor would they tolerate madness. 5. Not that they themselves, of course, would think of raising their hands in violence against the Empress and her representative. Perish the thought, perish the thought. Even if they were nothing but a couple of deranged females. But, six, the dreaded mob of Alexandria, always prone to erupt at the slightest provocation, was even now coming to a furious boil. Any moment now, madness would be unleashed in the streets, which, seven, was the inevitable fate for mad women. Eight, who were, they reiterated, utterly mad, insanity personified, completely out of their wits, bereft of all sense and reason, raving. Antonina had had enough. Arrest them, she said, demurely, ladylike. The whole lot. A little flip of the hand. Stow them in the hold of one of the grain ships for now. We'll figure out what to do with them later. As Ashot and his cataphracts carried out her order, Antonina ignored the squalls of outrage issued by the city's notables as they were hog-tied and frog-marched out of the palace. She had other problems to deal with. Some of those problems were simple and straightforward. Representatives from the very large Jewish population of the city inquired as to their likely welfare. Antonina assured them that the Jews would be unmolested, both in their civil and religious affairs, so long as they accepted her authority. 5 minutes later, the Jewish representatives were ushered out. On their way, Antonina heard one of them mutter to another, "Let the damn Christians fight it out, then. No business of ours." Good enough. Next problem. Representatives of the city's powerful guilds demanded to know what the Empire's attitude would be toward their ancient prerogatives. Complicated, but not difficult. Antonina assured them that neither she nor Emperor Phocius, nor the Emperor's regent, had any desire to trample on the guild's legitimate interests, other than, in the case of the shipbuilding and metalworking guilds, providing them with a lot of work. Oh yes, and work for the huge linen makers' guild also. Sales would be needed for all the new ships they'd be building. And no doubt there'd be some imperial money tossed at the glassworkers' guild. The Emperor's regent, as everyone knew, was exceedingly fond of fine glasswork. The papyrus makers, of course, were sitting pretty. The influx of imperial officers would naturally increase the demand for paper. As for the jewelers, well, what with the enormous booty that would soon be rolling in from the Malwa, writhing in defeat and humiliation, all of the soldiers, the many, many, many soldiers, would be arriving to strengthen Egypt's garrison would naturally want to convert their bulky loot into items which were both portable and readily liquefiable, of which, oh happy coincidence, fine jewelry took pride of place, especially the jewelry produced in Alexandria, which city was famed throughout the empire, oh happy coincidence, for the unexcelled craft of its gold and silversmiths. Now, as to the matter of grain shipping guilds, well, soldiers are strapping lads, need to eat a lot, so... 2 hours later, the representatives of the city's commercial and manufacturing guilds tottered out of the palace, reeling dizzily at the thought of their newfound wealth. Other problems, of course, were hard as nails. But those, at least, Antonina didn't have to spend hour after hour sitting on a chair to deal with. Those problems could only be dealt with in the streets. Hermogenes stalked into the audience chamber just as the last guild representatives were leaving. He strode directly to Antonina's chair, leaned over, and whispered, "It's starting. Paul just finished a sermon at the Church of St. Michael, calling on the city's faithful to reject the whore of Babylon." "Which one?" asked Antonina whimsically. "Me or Theodora?" Hermogenes shrugged. "From what our spies report, the patriarch wasn't specific. The former patriarch, I should say." Antonina shook her head. "He's still the patriarch, Hermogenes. In fact, if not in name. Theodosius may have the title, but it means nothing until we can install him in the Church of St. Michael and keep him there." She cast a glance at the man in question. Theodosius was standing 20 feet away, conferring with two of the deacons who served as his ecclesiastical aides. Zeno, the commander of the Knights Hospitaller, was standing next to him, along with two of his own subordinates. Antonina was pleased to note that Theodosius seemed neither agitated nor apprehensive. "I don't know about his theology, but the man's got good nerves. He'll need them." She looked back at Hermogenes. "What about Ambrose?" Hermogenes scowled. "The bastards hold up at the army camp in Acropolis, with all of his troops." Archote and Euphronius arrived just in time to hear the last words. "Only thing he can do for the moment," said Archote. "He's a general in the army, subject to the Empire's stringent rules governing mutiny. Whereas," the Armenian cataphract sneered, "the patriarch can give sermons and claim after that he was just preaching to his flock. No fault of his if he was misunderstood when he denounced the whore of Babylon. He was just cautioning men against sin. He certainly didn't intend for a huge mob to assault the Empress's representative. He's shocked and distressed to learn that the unfortunate woman was torn limb from limb." By this time, Theodosius and Zeno had joined the little circle around Antonina. "It's happened before," commented the knight's hospitaller. "The prefect Pretonius was stoned by the mob during Augustus's reign, and one of the Ptolemies was dragged out into the streets and assassinated. Alexander II, I think it was." Antonina pursed her lips. "How long do you think Ambrose will sit on the sidelines?" Ashote. The commander of her Thracian Bucellarii shrugged. "Depends on his troops, mostly. Ambrose only has three options." He held up his thumb. "One, accept his dismissal." "Not a chance," interjected Hermogenes. "I know the man. Sidis was being polite when he called him a stinking bastard. Ambitious he is." Ashote nodded. "Rule out that option, then. That only leaves him two." He held up his other thumb. "Mutiny, but—" Hermogenes started shaking his head. "That'd be insane," continued Ashote. "Every one of his soldiers knows the penalty for mutiny in the Roman army. The risk isn't worth it unless—" He held up his forefinger alongside his thumb. "Option two. Ambrose declares himself the new emperor. His soldiers hail him, start a civil war, and hope to enjoy the bounty if they win." Hermogenes nodded vigorously. "He's right. A patriarch can play games with street violence. A general can't. For him, it's all or nothing." Antonina looked back and forth between the two officers. "You still haven't told me how long I've got before he decides." "A day, at the very least," said Ashote immediately. "He's got to have the support of his soldiers. Most of them, anyway. That'll take time." "Speeches," amplified Hermogenes. "Perorations to the assembled troops. Negotiations with his top officers. Promises to make to everybody." "For sure, he'll promise a huge anona if he takes the throne," added Ashote immediately. All the officers nodded, their faces grim. The anona was the pay bonus which Roman emperors traditionally granted their troops upon assuming the throne. During the chaotic civil wars 3 centuries earlier, when Rome often had 2 or 3 simultaneous emperors, few of whom survived more than a year or two, the claimants for the throne had bid for the loyalty of the armies by promising absurd bonuses. "Pay increases," elaborated Hermogenes, "after he's been made emperor. Better retirement pensions, anything else he can think of." "He'll be talking non-stop for hours," concluded Ashote, "all through the day and halfway through the night." Antonina rose. "Right. The gist of it is that I've got a day to deal with the patriarch's mob without interference from the army of Egypt." Ashote and Hermogenes nodded. "Let's get to it, then. How big is that mob?" Ashote spread his hands. "Hard to know, exactly. Thousands from the crowd packing St. Michael's. Most will be his fanatic adherents, but there'll be a lot of Orthodox sympathizers mixed in with them." Then he turned to Theodosius. "How many hardcore Chalcedonian monks are there residing in the city?" The patriarch grimaced.
"At least 2,000.
5,000, added Zeno, "if you include the ones living in monasteries within a day's march of Alexandria." Ashote turned back to Antonina. "Every last one of those monks will be in with the mob, stirring them up."
"Leading the charge, more like," snarled Hermogenes.
Ashote barked an angry little laugh. "And you can bet that the Hippodrome factions will join the fray, the Blues for sure. They'll be interested in looting for the most part, but they'll throw their weight in on Paul's side if for no other reason than to get his blessing for their crimes."
"They'll head for Delta Quarter right off," added Zeno.
Antonina nodded thoughtfully. Alexandria was divided into 5 quarters, designated by the first 5 letters of the Greek alphabet. Delta Quarter for centuries had been the city's Jewish area. She moved her eyes to Euphronius. Throughout the preceding discussion, as was usual in these command meetings, the commander of the Theodoran cohort had said nothing. The young Syrian grenadier was too shy to do more than listen.
How do you feel about Jews? She asked him abruptly.
Euphronius was startled by the question.
Jews? He frowned. Never thought much about it, to be honest. Can't say I like them, but...
He fell silent, groping for words. Antonina was satisfied. Anti-Jewish sentiment was endemic throughout the Roman Empire, but only in Alexandria did it reach rabid proportions. That had been true for centuries. Syrians, on the other hand, had managed to coexist with Jews without much in the way of trouble.
I want you and the cohort to march to the Jewish quarter. It'll be your job to defend it against the Hippodrome thugs. Take one of Hermogenes' infantry cohorts for support. It was a shout in Hermogenes' turn to be startled now.
What for, Antonina? Asked Hermogenes. The Jews can take care of themselves. Won't be the first time they fought it out with blues and greens.
Antonina shook her head. That's exactly what I'm afraid of. I intend to, she clenched her fist, suppress this street violence. The last thing I want is for it to spread.
I agree with Antonina, interjected Theodosius. If the Jews get involved in street fighting, Paul will use that to further incite the mob.
Whereas, said Antonina, if the mob is stopped before it can even start the pogrom by the Empress's own cohort, it'll send a very different signal.
She straightened, back stiff.
I promised their representatives that Alexandria's Jews would be unmolested if they remained loyal to the Empire. I intend to keep that promise.
She began moving toward the great set of double doors leading out of the audience chamber, issuing commands as she went.
Hermogenes, detail one of your cohorts to back up the grenadiers in the Delta Quarter. Find one with officers who are familiar with Alexandria. The Syrians will get lost in the city without guides. Take Trifiodorus and his boys, Euphronius, said Hermogenes. He's from Alexandria.
He's a damn good tribune, too, agreed the Syrian grenadier, nodding with approval.
Antonina stopped abruptly. She turned to face the commander of the Theodoran cohort. Her expression was stern, almost fierce.
Good tribune or not, Euphronius, you're in charge. The infantry's there to back you up, nothing more.
Euphronius started to make some protest, but Antonina drove over it.
You've always been subordinate to someone else. Not today. Today you're leading an independent command. You're ready for it, and so are the grenadiers. I expect you to shine.
The young Syrian commander straightened.
We will, Antonina. We will not fail.
Antonina turned to Ashot and Hermogenes.
Get your troops ready. I want all of them in full armor. That includes the cataphract's horses. Full armor, nothing less. Make sure of it. In this heat, a lot of the men will try to slide through with half armor.
Full armor?
Ashot winced.
Be like an oven. Antonina, we're not dealing with Persian Dagons here for the sake of Christ. Just a pack of scruffy...
Antonina shook her head firmly.
That's overkill, I know, against a street mob. But your troops won't be in the middle of the action anyway, and I want them to look as intimidating as possible.
Ashot's eyes widened. So did Hermogenes.
Not in the middle of it? Asked the Armenian cataphract.
Antonina smiled, then turned to face Zeno.
I believe it's time for the Knights Hospitaller to take center stage.
Zeno nodded solemnly.
So do I, Antonina, and this is the perfect opportunity.
I'm not so sure about that, muttered Hermogenes.
He gave Zeno a half-apologetic, half-skeptical glance.
Meaning, no offense, but your monks have only had a small amount of training. This is one hell of a messy situation to throw them into.
Antonina started to intervene, but then, seeing the confident expression on Zeno's face, decided to let the Knight Hospitaller handle the matter.
We have trained much more than you realize, Hermogenes, said Zeno.
Not, he waved his hand, with your kind of full armor and weapons in a field battle situation, of course, but we took advantage of the very long voyage here to train on board the grain ships, with quarterstaffs.
Hermogenes stared at the Knight's Hospitaller as if the man had just announced that he was armed with breadsticks. Ashot was positively goggling.
Quarterstaffs? Choked the Armenian cataphract.
Now Antonina did intervene.
That was my husband's idea, she stated. He said it was the perfect weapon for riot duty.
Hearing the authority of Belisarius invoked, Ashot and Hermogenes reined in their disdain. A bit. Zeno spoke up again.
I don't think you fully understand the situation here, Hermogenes, Ashot. He cleared his throat. I am Egyptian myself, you know. I wasn't born in Alexandria. I come from Naucrates in the Delta. But I'm familiar with the place and its religious politics. He pointed through the open doors. We must be very careful. We don't want to create martyrs. And especially, we don't want to infuriate the great masses of Orthodox Greeks who make up a third of Alexandria's populace. He nodded approvingly at Antonina. You saw how well Antonina handled the guilds earlier, but you mustn't forget that almost all of those men are Greeks and Orthodox. They completely dominate the city's commerce and manufacture. They are the same men we will be relying on tomorrow and for years to come to forge the Roman arsenal against the Malwa. For doctrinal reasons, most of those people are inclined to support Paul and his diehards, but they are also uneasy about their fanaticism and their thuggery. Bad for business, if nothing else. Antonina pitched in. It's essential that we drive a wedge between Paul's fanatics and the majority of the Orthodox population. If we have a massacre, the city's Greeks will be driven into open opposition. And you know as well as I do, better than I do, how the cataphracts and the regular infantry will hammer into that mob if they're in the forefront. She stared at Ashot and Hermogenes. The two officers looked away. You know, she snapped. Those men are trained to do one thing and one thing only. Slaughter people. Do you really want to unleash a volley of cataphract arrows against a crowd? This is not the Nikar revolt, goddammit. There we were dealing with Malwa Kshatriya and thousands of professional thugs armed to the teeth. Here, she blew out her breath. Christ, half of that crowd will be there more out of excitement and curiosity than anything else. Many of them will be women and children. You may be crazy, but I'm not. Theodora sent me here to stabilize imperial rule in Egypt, to stop a civil war, not start one. Ashot and Hermogenes were looking hangdog now, but Antonina was relentless. That's the way it's going to be. I have complete confidence that the Knights Hospitaller can handle the situation. I simply want you there, in the background, but fully armed and armored, to add a little spice to the meal. Just to let the crowd know, after Paul's goons have been beaten into a pulp and routed, that it could have been one hell of a lot worse. She chuckled very coldly. You may sneer at quarterstaffs, but my husband doesn't, and I think by the end of the day you won't be sneering either. She straightened, assuming as tall a stance as she could, which wasn't much, but quite enough. You have your orders. Follow them. Hermogenes and Ashot left then very hastily. An unkind observer might have said they scurried. An instant later, Zeno followed. His pace, however, was slower. Very proud, that stride was. Euphronius also began to leave, but after taking three steps, he stopped. He fidgeted, then turned around. Yes? Asked Antonina. The Syrian cleared his throat. My grenadiers are also not trained to do anything other than, slaughter people. And grenades are even more indiscriminate than arrows. I don't understand how you expect me to... Antonina laughed. Euphronius, relax. She walked over, smiling, and placed a reassuring hand on his arm. First of all, you're not going to be dealing with a crowd. You're going to be dealing with gangs. There won't be any innocent onlookers in that mob, believe me. Hippodrome thugs they'll be, looking to pillage the Jews. Robbers, rapists, murderers. Nothing else. The smile vanished. Her next words were almost snarled. Kill as many of them as you can, Euphronius. The more the better. And then have Tryphiodorus and his infantry hang whatever prisoners you take. On the spot. No mercy. None. If you wind up draping the outskirts of the Delta Quarter with intestines, blood, brains, and corpses, you'll make me a very happy woman. Euphronius gave out a little sigh of relief. Oh, he said. Then, with a sudden savage grin, we can do that. No problem. Now he, too, was hurrying out of the room. Antonina was left alone with Theodosius. For a moment, she and the new patriarch stared at each other. Theodosius had said nothing during the preceding discussion, but his anxiety had been obvious to Antonina. The anxiety was gone now, but she was uncertain what emotion had replaced it. Theodosius was giving her a very odd look. Is something troubling you, Patriarch? Not at all, replied Theodosius, shaking his head. I was just... How can I explain?
He smiled, fluttering his hands.
I suppose you could say I was contemplating God's irony. It's an aspect of the supreme being which most theologians miss entirely, in my experience.
Antonina frowned.
I'm afraid I don't...
Again, the fluttering hands.
When the fanatic Paul calls you the whore of Babylon, he demonstrates his ignorance, his stupidity, actually. The essence of Christ is his mercy, Antonina. And who in this chaos called Alexandra could find that mercy, other than a woman who understands the difference between sin and evil?
Antonina was still frowning. Theodosius sighed.
I'm not explaining myself well. Let me just say that I am very glad that you are here, and not someone else. Someone full of their own self-righteousness. I will leave it at that.
Her frown faded, replaced by a half-rueful little smile.
I suppose I've adopted my husband's crooked way of looking at things.
Crooked? Perhaps.
The patriarch turned to go.
But I would remind you, Antonina, that a grapevine is also crooked, yet it bears the world's most treasured fruit.
When she was finally alone, Antonina walked slowly back to her chair and took a seat. She would not be able to enjoy that rest for long, for she intended to take her place with the cataphracts backing the Knights Templar. Within minutes, she would have to don her own armor and wear it throughout the day under the hammering sun of Egypt. She grimaced, thinking of the sweltering heat that armor would bring. But she needed that moment alone, to remember the crooked mind and the straight soul of her absent husband.
Be safe, love, she whispered. Oh, please, be safe.
Chapter 32. The Euphrates, autumn 531 AD.
This is ridiculous, snarled Belisarius.